Hi, Barry, about alcoholism. That was recorded at the California Northern Coastal Area Federal General Service Assembly held in San Mateo, California on November the 8th, 1975. Speaker, Carl Ruth Belford of New York City, a staff member of the New York General Service Office. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for entertainment or commercial purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of any speaker at any public level. The original of this recording and this copy were both made by Bart Daniel of 1332 Santa Ynez Way, Sacramento, California, zip 95816.
And now I'll have the speaker that we've all been waiting for, Carl Louise from New York.
Still drinking. Well, hi again, everyone. I am Carl Louise Belford, and I am a very grateful alcoholic. And really, my heart is very full tonight. Haven't we had a wonderful day? It impresses and touches me very much that you're all still here. And now you have my permission to go to sleep or at least take a little nap. I'm not going to keep you too long, I hope, but sometimes toward the end of the day, when you ought to be quick because you're beginning to run out of gas, you go a little longer than you plan to. I hope I won't keep you too long, though. I talked a little bit this morning about the office, and I'm not going to spend too much time on that tonight. But you know, it's impossible for me to tell my story, which is the story of my gratitude to AA, without mentioning what I'm doing now in AA. And in order to do that, I have to talk a little bit about the work that we're doing. You know, I was in Southern California last year, and AA was certainly alive and well there. And now I'm in Northern California, and I can go back and report to everybody that AA is just as alive and just as well in Northern California. It's really thrilling what you're doing out here. I can remember when I first came to the General Service Office, when there really wasn't any service structure at all, as we understand service structure, in the whole state of California. And now, look at all of you, GSRs, district committee members, area committee officers, past service people, been here all day long, and you've given every appearance of enjoying yourselves and having a good time. And this has got to be wonderful news. Now, AA is alive and well at your General Service Office. And it's alive and well at your General Service Conference. And it's alive and well on your General Service Board. Now, the board and the conference and the office are all service bodies. We are not a government for AA. We have no legislative powers whatsoever. We are there for the purpose, for the same primary purpose that exists for every AA group, which is to try to carry the message to alcoholics who still suffer. Now, group members and the conference and the board and the office may all go about this job of trying to carry the message in a slightly different way. In other words, we may all have a slightly different function, but that doesn't mean that we don't have the same primary purpose. Now, because our functions are different, And because all of us are inclined to become involved and immersed in what our particular functions are, we may overemphasize one thing from your point of view, and you might overemphasize one thing from our point of view. And I don't, George talked about this a little this afternoon, and I think it's one of the most important things for all of us to think about, which is that unity does not mean unanimity. We do not have to agree with one voice about everything. As someone said this afternoon, if two people agree about every single thing, one of them is unnecessary. So it's true that we may not agree always about everything. You may disagree seriously with actions of the General Service Board and with the performance of the General Service Office, and this is your privilege. And furthermore, you may be right and we may be wrong. There is always that very real possibility. But I think the important thing for us who must function in a state of unity is that we work together in trust, that we believe that each of us, with our different functions and same purpose, has the best interest of AA at heart, and that we can have honest disagreements without having unworthy purposes involved. Disagree with us. Tell us you disagree with us. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe we might even admit we're wrong sometimes, you know. But don't believe that we have any plot or anything that we're trying to keep from you or anything that we're trying to put over on you. I read a set of minutes from one of the southern states last year, and apparently there was a great deal of controversy going on about something that was happening at the office at that time. And finally, one of the members got up and said, "Look, these people are AA members just like you and I are, and they're really not trying to sell us down the river. And we're not trying to sell you down the river, and we know you're not trying to sell us down the river. And I don't even like to talk about we and they. We are one thing. All of us in this fellowship are one thing. We have the same primary purpose, and we have slightly different functions." Now, I was invited a number of years ago, and everybody who's ever been a delegate probably has heard me say this. I was, several years ago, when I had another assignment, invited to go over to Rutgers University and talk to the students over there about the fellowship of AA and about how AA could cooperate with others and what ways we could and in what ways we couldn't. And one of the professors at Rutgers asked me if I would come and talk to his class the next morning. And I said, "I'd be glad to. What would you like me to talk about?" And he said, "I want you to come and talk about AA structure." And I said, "You got to be kidding. You don't want me to come and talk about AA structure. I know you don't. AA members don't want me to come and talk about AA structure. And I know these people don't want to hear about structure." He said, "That's what I want you to talk about." And I thought, well, you know, he's zingy, but I'll do it. So I got there and I had a blackboard and I was going to draw the triangle on the blackboard and show him how it functions. And he began the lecture, and pretty soon I began to catch on as to why it was he wanted me to talk about AA structure. The purpose of his class was that he was teaching these people who would be getting a lot of money from the government and who would be setting up these facilities and agencies. He was trying to teach them how to structure their organizations in such a way that they could deliver their service to the person that it was aimed at, that is, the alcoholic. He said, "Now, I have invited the lady from Alcoholics Anonymous to come here and describe the structure of AA for you, because this is the organization that does the very best job of delivering its service. And the service that we have to deliver, of course, is the message that we carry. And I began to understand something about structure then, that it is a kind of communications network that we have. It's broken down into parts that are necessarily small enough so that communication can be at its most direct. And ever since then, I've thought of service in a different way. I thought of the structure in a different way, that it is through this structure that we're able to deliver our service, which is the message that we have to carry. Now, you know, I had been in AA for quite a long time before I learned something which has been terribly important to me ever since. I learned that the AA program is all one thing, that it is a program of recovery, unity, and service, that these are the three arms of our triangle, and that two arms cannot stand alone. We need all three. If it were not for the legacy of unity and the legacy of service, I might not have a recovery story to tell. Now, I didn't know this for a long time, because like everybody else, when I was first in AA, naturally, the only thing that I was interested in was the recovery part of the program. How does it work? What do I have to do to get what these people have? What do I have to do to learn to stay away from one drink for one day so that I, too, can become a sober person and lead a sober life? This was all I wanted to know, and I was greedy for it. The night that I went to my first meeting, I didn't have a sponsor. My husband had called up the New York Intergroup office, a service office, to find out where there was a meeting. And we had gone to this meeting together. And because we're both readers, we picked up every pamphlet off the table and we bought all the books and we went home and we started to read. And I read the big book in one sitting, the night after my first AA meeting. Nothing compulsive about me, you understand that. Now, that is not the last time I've read the big book, and I'm not trying to tell you that I learned what was in the big book that night. But I learned enough at that first meeting and from the reading of that book to stay away from one drink for another day and go to another meeting that night. Now, I was completely absorbed in this. I could hardly read it fast enough. I felt like every word in it was directed entirely to me. While I was reading this, my husband was reading not the 12 steps, but the 12 traditions. He already heard of the 12 steps. He already knew a little bit about the 12 steps. I think he even knew something about how to practice the 12 steps. But he'd never heard of these AA traditions before, and he kept interrupting me as I was reading the big book, saying, "Listen to this. This is the most amazing thing that I have ever heard of. The kind of wisdom and prudence and foresight that went into the writing of these traditions is nothing short of a miracle. Imagine," he said to me, "an organization which not only does not accept any money from outside, but even puts a limit on the money that its members can give." And I said, "Yes, isn't that nice?" And went on reading my book. And then he would interrupt again, "Listen to this." And then he would get to the sixth tradition about, you know, not engaging in any kind of education programs, not espousing any causes, not endorsing anything. "Oh," he said, "if the organizations that I'm involved in, if only they functioned this way." And I said, "That's fine, you know," and I went right on reading the book. It was a very long time before I realized that it wouldn't make any difference how wonderful this program of recovery were if there weren't a place where I could go and learn about it. How do these places in rooms like this all over the world, how do they stay open? What happens in these rooms? There are people who come there and provide services. Somebody said service in AA starts with a broom. Somebody sets up the table. Somebody puts out the ashtrays. Somebody sets up the literature table and puts those pamphlets and those books that come from somewhere on the literature table. Somebody else leads the meeting. Somebody else greets the newcomers at the door. And when you sit down and the meeting begins, what do we hear? Not about whether my education program is better than your education program. Not about whether my facility is better than your facility. Not about whether I am the member of the group who is to appear on television next week, or whether somebody else from the group should appear on television next week. Not whether we should invest our money in a hospital or in a radio station where we can publicize AA. What we talk about is the program. We talk about the thing that brings us together in the first place. And this is what I think the traditions really are. Because most AA members, most places, most of the time, live by these traditions. They set us free to do our thing. We don't have to argue about all of these things because we are not involved with these things. Therefore, we can talk about the thing that we come together to talk about in the first place, which is how we stay sober a day at a time and how we can carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer. Now, I had never heard of an intergroup office, and I had been in AA quite a long time before I'd heard of an AA General Service office. But in that meeting that first night that I went to, very real services were provided by somebody in the way of all that literature that I took home with me. And the literature really that kept me sober almost as much as the meetings did during the first 3 months. And there was somebody on the other end of the telephone when my husband called that night, when we needed help so desperately to find out where there was a meeting that we could go to. Now, without those things happening, maybe the other wonderful, great blessing and miracle that happened in my life that night would not have been able to happen. I want to share an experience with you of a place where this is not happening, or at least it was not happening at the time that I had the overseas service. There is a country in Europe which wanted to translate the big book and publish it in its own language. There's another language which is very close and very similar, and most of the people who speak the language in this country can read the other language, but they wanted their own. Before the board of directors of AA World Services can give permission and lend the money to back the publication of something of this kind, of an undertaking of this size, they have to do a fair amount of research to find out what the chances are of the AA members in a given country being able to support the publication and sale of a big book. I had the overseas assignment, and so we started in on trying to get the kind of information that we needed. In studying, we found out that the membership in this country had not changed in almost 20 years. That 20 years earlier, the membership had been almost as great as it was at this time. And we began to try to find out why this was. So I had a lot of correspondence with members of their board, most of whom spoke very good English. And they had a very distinguished non-alcoholic who spoke perfect English, who was involved in all their activities, and he was back and forth frequently in New York, so he would come to the office to talk with us. we found out that they had accepted a large sum of money from a big electrical company, and they had put this money in escrow simply because they had never been able to agree among themselves how to spend it. Their meetings were not held in churches or in meeting rooms, which they rented, but they were held in the rehabilitation facility of this doctor who was frequently visiting us in New York. The doctor chose the people from his facility who were to go to the AA meeting. He was very proud of the fact that there was a room in his building which was called Bill's Room. He had given the room for that. They had a publication not like Al Grapevine. It was a monthly publication, but it was aimed at the big industries and at the public media. In other words, it was trying to, well, let's use the word, it was promoting AA with these people. For what purpose, I don't really know, because they already had a lot of money from outside people. Okay. Sometime later, I met a drunk who had been in this facility, which was a very good one, as facilities go, and I said, tell me about the AA meeting. He said, what AA meeting? I said, well, what about Bill's room? What happens there? He said, oh, I went there once. And I said, well, what happened? He said, there were a bunch of people there, but they spent their time arguing about what to do with that money that they had, that somebody had given them. Who should be put on the list to receive this publication? And then they were interested in having a professional writer write really dramatic stories to put in the story section of the big book so it would really sell. Now, this country had not grown, the AA membership had not grown in 20 years. Now, I've named at least five of the traditions which were being honored in their breach in this country, and they could make no connection whatever between these things. But there was the sick drunk. Nobody in there carrying any message because they're so busy arguing among themselves about these things that the traditions really free us from. You know, when I went to my first AA meeting, I really thought that I had come to the end of the line. I had no idea what was ahead for me. It never occurred to me at that time that I would ever have any kind of story to tell anyone. You've given me the opportunity to do the thing that I like to do best, which is to talk about the office, to talk about the work that's being done at AA Worldwide. But you've given me also the opportunity to do the thing that I never miss a chance to do, which is to try in some small way to express my gratitude to this fellowship by telling you my story, how it was, what happened, and how it is now. And I never want to miss an opportunity to do this because this is the story of the transforming experience of my life. Because during the years that I drank, I became the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. Destructive, irrational, and unpredictable. And I know now that I am the same person who walked in the door at that first meeting at the Old Manhattan Group in New York on September 6, 1957, that I am the same person that I was then, but my life is totally different. Because you have taught me how to change my attitude towards my life and towards other people and towards myself. You have taught me the way to begin the process of becoming a different kind of person. And I hope in the process of telling you my story that I will be able to express to you in any way at all the real depth of my gratitude for this very great gift. because when I arrived here, I had really tried everything else. I was at the end of the line, and I thought it was the end of my life. I was terrified, like everybody is. I was sick with shame and humiliation. And I would not have believed at that time that the day would ever come when I would be able to look back on the years that preceded my arrival in AA and accept the fact that they were probably, for me, the necessary preparation for the kind of thing that I have found since coming into AA. I think I was one of the people who simply had to go through the painful and humiliating experience of those terrible years. If I was ever going to be able to engage in any kind of self-confrontation, partial though I know that still is, I thought that I was a special case. I know there's nothing unusual in this. We all think we are special cases. I learned when I got here that there was absolutely nothing special about me, that I was as different as my fingerprint and as similar in my disease as it is possible to be to all the rest of you. I immediately began to learn when I put myself in your care. I immediately began to learn some very important things. And I use the word began quite deliberately because there are things that I still have to remind myself of every single day. I learned, for instance, that I not only do not, but that I cannot control anything or anybody, not even myself, by my efforts alone. I need help. I need the kind of help that comes from the grace of a loving God, as I understand him. I need the kind of help that comes from this program and the kind of help that comes from loving family and friends, both inside and outside AA. I learned that I don't have to be a winner. I learned that sometimes the times that I have, when I had thought I was losing, were the times that I really won. For instance, when I lost the battle with alcohol. I learned that I had the right to be wrong. I learned that I had the right to make mistakes and errors in judgment. I learned that I had the right to make poor choices. And I learned that the only thing that would be really fatal for me would be if I should cease to care. That if I should cease to be fully committed and truly concerned about the principles of this program and the power greater than myself that I call God, who has seen me through so much this far along the way. Now, I have never been the kind of person who had much faith in my own ability to accomplish anything worthwhile. I learned after I put myself in your care that it didn't matter very much whether I had faith in myself or not, so long as I had faith in the higher power that I call God. I don't know why I was such a slow study. I thought I was so smart. I thought I was so quick. I thought I was so bright. And it took me so long to learn any lesson that has any real importance because they were all too simple for me. And the only thing that was worthy of my attention was something that was highly complicated and highly complex. And then I got here and I found out it ain't that kind of program. Thanks be to God. I drank for a few years without having any trouble. I began to drink actually sort of late in life for an alcoholic. I was 26 years old, married, and the mother of two little girls before drinking was anything but a very occasional experience for me. And I had a few happy occasions with mild, pleasant drinking right here in San Francisco in the fall of 1944, just before my husband went overseas. I left my husband here the 1st of December, I guess it was, and 1944, and I went back to the South, where I spent the rest of the war with my two children. And I took my role as a war widow very hard. I played it to the hilt. I acted as though I was the only one instead of one of hundreds of thousands of women in the same circumstances. And it was during this time that drinking became a sort of daily occurrence with me. I was taking my war widowhood hard, and I was not sleeping well, and I was full of anxieties and had so many responsibilities and so on. And I used to get together in the afternoon with other war widows who had the same kind of burdens and responsibilities, only they didn't seem to agonize over them quite as much as I did. And we used to share our experience, strength, and hope together over a few drinks. And this became a daily custom with us. We'd turn the children loose in the sand piles, and we'd sit on the porch and rock and drink a little. And we didn't drink too much. We just had a nice, pleasant time, and I thought this was an absolutely great custom. The fact that I enjoyed this so much didn't bother me particularly. Looking back on it now, I can see that I had begun to associate this time of day with, you know, relaxation and release from anxiety and tension. And this was when I was comfortable. This was when I was enjoying myself. And I think, looking back on it, that maybe you could say that drinking meant something to me that it didn't mean to these other women. But this didn't bother me, and it wouldn't have bothered me even if I had been aware of it at the time, because nothing bothered me about it as long as I was able to handle it well in fairly large amounts. Now, I was inordinately proud of my capacity to drink, and I used to feel 10 feet tall when we were going on a picnic or a party, and somebody would say, "Who's going to drive the car home? Everybody's going to be drunk." And they would say, "Cora Weiss can drive this car home. She's never drunk." And I thought this was wonderful. You know, something special. They gave him a driver's license because they thought I could drive it, you know, safely. But I thought this was something remarkable. When my husband came home from the war, this was supposed to be like waving the fairy wand, and we were to live happily ever afterwards, and all my problems would be over. And it didn't quite work out like that. Shortly after Lee came home from overseas, we moved to New York to live a year. That was in 1946, and we've been there ever since. And we began to have problems. He had been overseas with the Marines through some pretty gruesome things. I had been at home, living an entirely different kind of life, and the communication between us was not what it once was. The understanding and the sympathy did not seem to be what it once was. I was highly nervous and distraught about this whole situation. My husband had noticed when he came home that drinking had become a regular daily occurrence with me, but he didn't criticize it. He just noticed it and joined me. And we never drank too much. We had a couple of drinks before dinner, a couple of drinks after dinner, every now and then get a little bit high, but really nothing serious. So this was not the problem, but there were real problems between us. And when Lee had been home for about a year and we were still in New York, it was decided that I should go to see a shrink. And this insulted me. We had problems, but I was the one who had to go to see the shrink. I didn't like this, but I was very serious about wanting to save this marriage. I was very serious about wanting to be a good mother to my children. And I didn't like how I was feeling, and I didn't like what was happening, and I was willing to do what I had to do in order to get well and help the situation to get well. And I went to the shrink, and I had been going to this man 18 months before I had ever been drunk in my life. And when I hear all the professionals today talk about early intervention, I wonder, how early can you intervene? This guy had me before I had ever been drunk. And I used to accuse him of making an alcoholic out of me, that I wasn't an alcoholic when I came, and he made one of me. This I say in jest, I have great respect for this man. He was extremely kind to me. He supported me through a very difficult period of my life. He kept me going, I think, so that I could finally get here. Now, the fact that he could not help me with my drinking was hardly his fault, since I categorically refused to discuss it with him. But I'm getting ahead of the story. After I had been in therapy with this man for about 18 months, going 3 and 4 times a week, you know, not just occasional visits, but the real job, I was at a party one night, and I was drinking in the usual manner and in the usual amounts, only a very strange and peculiar thing happened to me this night. I got very drunk, and I had a blackout, and I was completely unprepared for either thing. I had never even heard of a blackout. I didn't know what it was. And I had always taken a very cavalier attitude towards drinking, that if one could not drink well, that meant like I drank, then one shouldn't drink at all. You can see I had quite a long way to fall. At any rate, I had never heard of a blackout, and I remembered nothing that had happened the night before, except I remembered that I had fallen down a flight of stairs, landed on my head on a stone terrace, and so I thought I must have a concussion, and that's why I didn't remember anything. And I was too ashamed of the cause of the fall to go to a doctor to find out if I'd split my head open or not. But I did discuss this with a therapist, and really he said all the things that I wanted to hear. And he did this out of innocence. He told me that this was the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally, and that in my case, he thought it was really a good sign, because it meant that the armor was breaking, and at least the liquor could get through to me now. And so this meant that the therapy was going to open up and we were going to make great progress. However, he did suggest that perhaps I should be extra careful about any drinking that I did until we resolved some rather difficult problems that we were working on at that time. And I agreed with him wholeheartedly, and I intended to be careful, and I tried. God knows I tried. I tried to be careful in every way that I could think of, in every way that anybody could suggest to me. The trouble was, of course, that I had already lost the ability to be careful. I didn't know this. The therapist didn't know this. My family didn't know this. My friends didn't know this. None of us knew that I had already crossed whatever that invisible line that we speak of is. That line that separates people who can drink from people who can't. Even if I had known it at the time, I would not have been able to believe it. I simply would not have been able to believe that I had reached the point of no return as far as alcohol was concerned. I thought my life was awry, I thought my values were awry, and I thought when I was able to get all this together again, when this great girl that they all refer to as the real me was finally released and let out of this box, that I would be able to put order in my life again, and naturally in that order, drinking would fall into its proper place. And so I continued on this, what became a really mad, frantic, wild search for this will-o'-the-wisp that was referred to as the real me. I put myself on a treadmill of activity. In this period of my life, I always look back on with sheer exhaustion, just thinking about the number of hours that I put in every day, running, running, running. It reminds me of Alice in Wonderland when the Red Queen says, down here you have to run as fast as you can to stay where you are. And I was running faster all the time, and I wasn't staying where I was, though the progression was very slow and very gradual. I did know what was happening. I knew that I was slipping back all the time. I knew that I was drying up inside like a leaf in the fall. I knew how empty and frightened I was, and the only way that I knew to fill this emptiness and to quiet these fears was to drink again. Always thinking that one day it will be better. One day I will be able to drink like I used to, and time after time after time I plunged in. Knowing full well that in the morning I would not have solved anything, and that in addition to all the things that I had been trying to solve, I would have instead to cope with the horrors of my remorse. And I know I don't have to describe that to any of you, because you all know too well what it's like. This terrible sense of self-hatred and self-contempt and terror. And this running of mine was running in terror because I was running away from the knowledge that I had really reached the point of no return as far as alcohol was concerned. Now, I endowed this search for the real me, as we called it, with every ounce of energy and imagination and resource that I had, and it was a lot. I was young then, and I was healthy, and boy, I really gave it my all. I continued to search for it in psychotherapy. I had had 18 months of therapy before I had ever been drunk, and I stayed with that same therapist for another 7.5 years. But never again after that first time did we ever discuss my drinking. I never showed up at his office really drunk. I showed up so hungover some days that I could hardly find my way to fall out on the couch when I got there. I would plan to talk about it. I wanted to talk about it. I would make up my mind in the subway when I was on the way to the office what I was going to say to him about it. And then I would get there and this panic would seize me and I would have to make up a story that would account for the kind of condition that I was in without discussing my drinking. I think he suspected things every now and then, but he wasn't the kind of therapist who ever presented you this. You had to say it to him, and I wasn't saying it, not to anybody. So this went on for 7.5 years, and I finally was the one who discontinued the therapy. I told him that I was not getting anywhere, and I knew I was not getting anywhere, and that I was going to have to try to find another answer. He let me go, not with any regrets, I think, but I think he was sorry about what happened. Several years later, the year that we had the International Convention in Long Beach, the Trustee Public Information Committee asked about 20 people to do 5-minute radio tapes. And these were played all over the country. And one night my phone rang when these tapes were being done, and it was this therapist, and I hadn't heard from him since I had been there for my last session. And he said, "I heard you on the radio this afternoon." I didn't even remember what he was talking about. And I said, "How was that?" He said, "Well, you didn't give your name, but I recognized your voice." And I said, "Oh, you mean you heard the, he said, "Yes, I heard the AA thing." I said, "Oh." He said, "I want to tell you, I'm so glad about this. And I will never let another patient go through what you went through." He said, "I knew what was wrong. And I should have told you that the only place that you could get any help would be in AA. But," he said, "I never could bring myself to do it. But from now on, that's what I'm going to do." So at least the therapy had that advantage. Not only did I continue to look for whatever I was looking for in the therapy, I looked for it in books and study. I was always signing up for a course at Columbia, NYU, or the New School, thinking that if I could learn how other people had lived, if I could participate in this wisdom, that I would be able to apply it to my own life. But I didn't seem to find any cases that were like mine. Nothing ever seemed to apply to me, because I was such a yes but girl. You've met a few others, I'm sure I have. I looked for it in worthy causes, thinking that if I could find something bigger than I was that I could throw myself into, that I would be able to lose myself and drink normally again, but I didn't find anything that big. I looked for it in books, in domesticity and in home life. My house has never been so clean because I couldn't clean up anything inside of me. Everything outside had to be just so. I've never given so many parties or such elaborate ones, and are ones that surprised me so much because I would lose track of who I had telephoned halfway through inviting the people to the party, and I never knew whether to prepare for 5 or 50 because I just simply couldn't remember what I had done. I looked for it in my religion, which I had turned my back on many years before. I thought it was an atheist. But I was hanging low and I was willing to try anything. But I had it all wrong. And I had to come to AA to find out how wrong I had it. I went to church and tried to say my prayers in order to make sure that God knew what my will for me was. And I had to learn after coming here that it works the other way around. And I even looked for my answers at the most unlikely place of all, perhaps, at Ebbets Field in the days when the Brooklyn Dodgers were still there. Now, I had been a baseball fan all my life, and I loved the Dodgers, and I used to go to occasional home games. But as my children got older and they went away to camp in the summer, they went to spend the summer with my mother. The drinking was getting very much worse in the summertime because those few controls that I permitted in my life at all were gone when the children were away. And I was looking for a way not to drink. And I thought if I have to go to Ebbets Field on the subway and get home on the subway, I won't drink so much. So I got all my family to go together and give me a season ticket to all the Dodgers home games. And 77 times every summer. I'm not compulsive, you know. I would get on the subway and go to Brooklyn and watch the baseball game and get on the subway and come home, and I discovered beer. Beer and baseball. Now, this was wholesome, healthy. You were out in the sunshine, in the fresh air, and everybody knew that beer was mild and it had malt in it. It gave it to people who needed to gain weight. Not that I ever did, but at any rate, I discovered beer. And the beer vendors discovered me. And when they came around at the 7th inning on their last go-round, they left 3 cans of beer with me and would say to me, "I sure hope the game doesn't go into extra innings. I don't know what you'll do if it does." Anyway, to all those things, you see, I was trying all these things simultaneously. And at the same time, I was also trying a surefire remedy. I was also looking for my answers in the contents of a bottle. And here I really did always find that key that I was looking for. But the door that it unlocked was not the door that I was looking for, because it was the door to a Pandora's box of destructive, unpredictable, irrational behavior. The woman that came out of this bottle was something that was terrifying to me. And I believed in the deepest part of me that the person that came out of that bottle was me. Not this person who was making attempts at worthwhile living. This was someone who had a very thin veneer of civilization, who was making phony efforts to lead a phony life. And I was really convinced that the real me was this thing, this creature, that came out of this bottle. Now, the chaos and confusion that were created in my life and in the lives of all of those people people who were close to me by this attempt that I made to live two lives simultaneously, one on a fairly rational plane and the other on this destructive, irrational plane, finally brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the effort any longer. The gap was simply too wide between this person who made attempts at worthwhile living and this creature who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned and kicked over every single good thing she did. This gap seemed to me too wide ever to be able to bridge, and I could not imagine that such a bridge ever existed. And I concluded that I was some sort of no-good freak who had had every kind of opportunity that a person can be given in this life and still couldn't make the scene. I thought I was sort of Typhoid Mary of the human race. You get near me and I'll infect you. Put me in your organization, I'll ruin it for you. Expose your children to me, I'll ruin them for you. This was what I thought of myself. At the same time, I began to realize that no matter what, something had to be done about the drinking. And it was in this beat and burnt out and flattened out state of mind that I came to my first AA meeting. And I hadn't been going to AA meetings very long before I found that key that I had been looking for so many years in so many unlikely places. Now, I didn't open all the doors right away. It still hasn't, and I know, of course, that it never will. But it opened the first door when I was able to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. When I was able to accept the fact that there was nothing that I could do to change that, but that I could change the meaning of it and take the destruction out of it by becoming a sober alcoholic one day at a time. Now, I want to share with you for just a minute a couple of experiences I had during the last week of my drinking, because they're so significant to me. And I learned so many lessons, which I still have to fall back on. About a week before I went to my first AA meeting, I called up the children's pediatrician, who was a neighbor and a friend, and asked him if he and his wife could come over for the evening. The children were still gone for the summer. They were coming back the next week. And there were some problems that I was having with one of the children that I wanted to discuss with them, and they came. And when they arrived, I wasn't drunk, but I wasn't sober. I'd been drinking a little bit, and I was always a good hostess, very eager to pour for everybody so I could pour a little more for myself. So all of us had a few drinks, and I guess I was getting tighter as the evening wore on. And as I was talking to him, he stopped me. And he said, "I have to say something to you, and I should have said it years ago." He said, "You can't do anything about this problem that you've got, or any other problem that you've got, unless you do something about your drinking, because it's out of control. And I want you to let me call Dr. Ruth Fox, and I want you to go to see her." Now, Dr. Fox is a psychiatrist in New York who specializes in alcoholism. And I said, "No, I'm not going to see Dr. Fox. No more money is going to be spent on me. I'm going to have to try to find another way." And I was just as mad as he thought I was going to be. Oh, now, I wasn't mad at him. I was mad at my husband because I thought he'd been ratting on me. See, I didn't think this doctor had gotten his medical degree. He had sense enough, you know, to be able to smell and see and hear and all those things. I thought Lee had to tell on me. So I was in a hurry to get him out of the house so I could give Lee hell, and I did. And I gave Lee real hell for the next week. And it was the most desperate drinking that I think I ever did. And it was the only time I think that Lee was ever really tempted to have me hospitalized, because he thought I was dangerous to myself, and he knew damn well I was dangerous to him. At any rate, that was a Thursday night that the doctor was at our house. The next Friday afternoon, when I had postponed taking the first drink as long as I possibly could, I knew about postponing it before I came here because I'd been practicing it for years. Long about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I couldn't postpone it any longer. And I began to drink, and it was a day like any other day, and I began to drink like I had on 1,000 other afternoons. Only this time, something very big happened to me. The biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. Suddenly, I realized it's not going to get better. This is how it's going to be. Milton was right. You can't solve any problem that you've got unless you do something about this. I hated what alcohol did to me. I had hated it for years. I was so sick and tired of it, and I had been so sick and tired of it for years. And suddenly I had this moment of truth when I saw the real helplessness and hopelessness and near despair of my situation. Now, all of this went through in a flash, and as it was going through my mind, I was on my way to the telephone, and I picked it up, and I called my husband, and for the first time in my life, I said something appropriate about my drinking. I said, please try not to be angry. I know I'll be drunk when you get home tonight, but I hope it will be the last time. And then from out of the blue came the words that subsequently changed my life. I said, if you will call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to try it. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I know if I am, it's not my fault, but it will be my fault if I don't try to find out and do something about it. We know it's helped lots of people with a drinking problem. It doesn't cost a thing, so what have we got to lose? And what did I have to lose? Only all those things that I had been struggling for so many years to get rid of. Things like anxiety and alienation and fear and anger and hostility. And what did I have to find instead? All those things that I had been looking for all those years in so many strange places. Things like faith and friendship and meaning and purpose in my life. But I didn't know any of this then. I didn't know what lay ahead of me. My husband gasped for breath as we talked on the phone. He didn't know what to say except, yes, 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 of course, okay, fine, goodbye. He hung up. As I put the phone down, it rang, and it was the children's doctor. And he said, I want to know if you've been thinking about the conversation that you and I had last week. And I said, wait a minute till I sit down. You have stunned me. And then I told him about the conversation that I just had with Lee. He said, you agreed to go to AA? And I said, well, yes. He said, that's the very best thing in the world you could do. But I wouldn't dare suggest it. Now, why won't they dare suggest it? He will now. He'll dare suggest it now, I'll tell you. I see him frequently. We talk about it all the time. Why do they... Are they afraid of suggesting it? And then he told me about patients that he had whose parents were in AA, and it turned out that one of his patients was one of the girls who worked at the AA General Service Office at that time, though I didn't know, of course, then. And I said, Milton, I'm scared to go alone. Do you think it would be childish of me if I asked Lee to go with me? And he said, listen, you ask Lee, and if Lee doesn't want to go, you call me up, and I'll go with you. Just go. So I hung up the phone, and I felt great. Right on dead center of the universe. I had made a big decision, and I owed myself a drink to congratulate myself. So I started. And now I was not having sad drinks anymore. I was really enjoying myself. And I always say that I got to AA through the grace of God and telephonitis. Because after I got a few, I got on the telephone. And I spread the good news. about this big decision that I had made. And not one person said, you don't need that. All of them said, isn't that wonderful? So the next day when I came to, you couldn't call it woke up, but when I came to, I began to have second thoughts about this big decision that I had made the night before. And all my friends knew my ways, and my phone began to ring. And everybody called me up. Oh, Carter Weed, I just wondered if you remembered the telephone conversation that we had yesterday, you know, about going to AA. I said, yes, thanks very much. I do remember. Goodbye. And this went on 3 or 4 times, so I knew I was stuck with it. I already knew enough about AA to know that you didn't teach people how to drink. I already knew you didn't. So I couldn't take a drink. This was the Labor Day weekend. I was expecting my sister and a heavy drinking friend. They were coming to spend the weekend. I had not yet been to my first AA meeting. And here I was stuck with having to stay dry on ice water all weekend while everybody boozed it up. And I did. And I had a long, sad, tragic face. My life was over. Theirs was fine, but mine was over. And this was how I would spend the rest of my life, watching other people having fun. When my sister left on Tuesday morning after Labor Day, she said, honey, you got to find a better way than this because we really can't take it. We would rather have you drunk than like this. Okay, now everybody had gone and it was Tuesday. And it was upon me. I had to go to the AA meeting that night. I never spent such a miserable day in my life. As we walked out of the house that night, I remember thinking, you have really done it now. You have really lost your way. You are about to take a plunge into the darkness. And now I know, but I didn't know then, that the plunge that I took was a leap of faith. And the darkness was better than any light that I had ever known. And the way that I found was better than any way that I had ever known. Now, I was bleeding then, and I had thought that I was bleeding because my spirit had been broken. I have come to find out that what was broken was my will and my pride, and that they had to be broken because they had never learned how to bend. And I hope they never fully recover from this body blow that they suffered that day. But I was in pain then, and I didn't know what to expect. And as Lee and I paced up and down in front of the old Manhattan group, we were going to a beginner's meeting first. I thought, oh my God, if I ever needed a drink in my life, I need it now. And Lee said, well, when the meeting's over at least, let's just go on in. Well, I said, I'm shaking. And they're liable to get me to sign up or sign my name or fill out a form, and I couldn't write. Well, I'll fill it out for you if they want you to fill out a form or anything. No, well, I thought you had to fill out a form and you belonged here or something like that. But anyway, we went on to this beginner's meeting, and this marvelous man was leading the meeting. He and his wife became my husbands and my closest friends. And I was sitting there looking at the floor, but I was listening. I didn't know it, but I was. I heard every word that was said. And he said one of those little AA home truths. I hadn't read it in any of those books that I'd studied, or hadn't heard it in any of that expensive therapy and counseling that I'd had. But he said, you know, you can't be a little bit alcoholic any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. It's just a question of how far the condition has progressed. And all of a sudden, my ears opened up and I heard every word he said. I had a brother who was a full-fledged alcoholic, and I thought I was a little bit alcoholic. And now I realize that I was just in a different stage of progression, and I began to listen. I didn't say anything. When he asked the questions after it was over, few people asked questions, and then my uncle put his hand up, and he said, what do you do when that time of day arrives? When you think you're going to die of anxiety, and you're so tense you can't breathe, what do you do? And the leader of the meeting said, well, sir, what time of day is your particular monsoon hour? And Lee didn't say anything, and finally I looked up, and then this teeny little voice that you could hardly hear, I said, he's not talking about himself. He's talking about me. And the wife of the leader of the meeting was sitting next to me, and she put her arm around me, and she said, you're going to be all right. I know you're going to be all right. And I was. And I really have been ever since. We went downstairs after the beginner's meeting, and there was an open meeting going on. This was the old Manhattan group, which was right on the edge of the Bowery in those days, and a lot of the boys used to drift up there at night to get a little coffee and cake and all. And the regular speakers hadn't all showed up, and every speaker was a man, and every one of them had a very low-bottom story and had spent some time on the Bowery. Now, this lovely lady whose husband had been leading the beginner's meeting was very nervous about this. And she kept whispering to me, saying, I hope you'll go to a meeting tomorrow night. And most of them aren't like this. Usually there's a woman speaker, and usually the stories are not as rough as this. And I kind of smile at her. And Lee, sitting on the other side, scared to death what I was going to do to him when we got out of the meeting, said, do you want to leave? Maybe I shouldn't have brought you here. You never did anything like this. Maybe this isn't the place for you. And I turned to him and I said, why don't you shut up and let me listen to what they're saying? And once again, he gulped hard because this was a new quantity sitting beside him. Something had happened which had absolutely nothing to do with me. Nothing to do with me. But for once at least in my life, I was able to suspend judgment and analysis and opinion and criticism and listen, and consequently to learn a little bit and to begin to learn some of the things that I really wanted to know. And you know, when I think about service now, I think about that guy who was leading that beginner's meeting, for instance. He was just doing something that his group asked him to do, just performing an AA service. He did not know that he was going to say something that was going to change the life of one woman and her husband and her children and all those people that were close to her. And whenever I'm asked to do anything in AA now, I think about that. And I think, just maybe, it happened once and it might happen again. And after that, of course, AA became for me a kind of school, and it still is, where I began the process of learning the things that I really always had wanted to know, which were how to lead a life that had some meaning and some purpose. And in all of this, I found the tools from the experience of people like you, and I found the incentive from the kind of example that was set for me by people like you. And I found the courage from the unfailing strength and support of people like you in rooms like this to begin this process of trying to live my life a new way, one day at a time. Staying away from one drink for one day, walking hand in hand with all of you on a journey, not a trip, a journey which has no end, a journey that we're all taking together. Now, I do not have the words to express my gratitude for all of this. I simply do not have them, and I never will. And so I have to give at least partial evidence of my gratitude by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it, who were the ones who showed me the difference between futility and a kind of fulfillment, between despair and hope, between slavery and freedom, really. Now it's getting late, but I have one more thing I have. have to tell you, and then I'm really going to quit. I have one story that I always tell every time I speak, not because it's the worst thing that I ever did or the thing with the most far-reaching consequences, but because I think it sort of puts my life in a capsule and shows what happened as a result of alcoholic drinking and what might have been expected of me. My husband is an Episcopal clergyman, and he is also the chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. And he's a full-time professor, and he simply has a Sunday sort of home parish where he serves when he's in the city. And a couple of years before I came to AA, he asked me if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and staff from NYU, and I agreed, of course, to do this, and I worked hard to make the party a success. I never had sense enough to know that I was going to fall flat on my face at these things. I always assumed, well, of course I'll do it. I was going to prove to him that I was just fine. I never was, but I was always going to prove that I was just fine. So I worked hard to make this party a success, and oh, in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, I was all through everything I had to do, and I thought it'd be a good idea if I took a nap before the company came. And then I had one of those inspirations that occur with such depressing frequency to alcoholics. I thought, I'll have a nice little glass of sherry, and this will help me become drowsy. Now, you know, sherry, a little ladylike drink. I knew perfectly well that a little glass of sherry didn't make me drowsy, that it took a little bottle or two little bottles of sherry to make me drowsy. And I also knew long before AA that it was the first drink that got me into all the trouble. What I didn't know was how to stay away from the first drink. I thought I could apply reason, and so I applied reason. And I said to myself for the thousandth time, any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this, and I took the first drink, and you know what happened. I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I never did. I didn't have luck enough to pass out. I never did do that either. I showed up at this party, almost falling down drunk, near hysterics, which I always was when I drank, muttering a stream of what I hope was incomprehensible gibberish. I say this with feeling because what I had to say was highly uncomplimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that most people associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party were almost all total strangers to me. We're Episcopalians who take a fairly relaxed attitude towards social drinking. Nobody took a relaxed attitude towards my drinking, which was not really social, it was antisocial. But the people at this party mostly came from a sort of temperance background. They didn't really understand drinking, I don't think. They didn't even smoke, for instance. Now, these were the kinds of people that I call squares. And I call them this at the top of my lungs and to their face all night long. Now, you talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, clergyman's wife, the hostess, drunk and disorderly. And I had the nerve to be deliberately insulting to these people who were really behaving rather well in what you will admit were difficult circumstances. Now, the day after this party, my remorse was spectacular. I wanted to crawl into a hole with the rest of the rats and get lost. But I was so locked up in this miserable little alcoholic trap, and I was so involved in my own agony that I wasn't even able to tell my poor husband that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know I was sorry. I thought he ought to know that no one would behave this way if she could help herself. I don't know whether he knew that or not, but I do know, after that party, he knew that I no longer drank because I had unresolved personality problems. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. Now, you might imagine that a stunt like this would constitute a bottom in my circumstances, but I didn't draw any such conclusion. I decided something had to be done about the drinking, and I set out to do it with indifferent success, but more than I deserved in any case. But I don't recommend my system to anybody who is even fairly new and who hasn't tried it, because I learned some new things about loneliness. And I had thought I already knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I didn't have a good reason to be lonely, with a fine husband and two wonderful children, and what could have been an interesting life, the fact that I had these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness, only convinced me I was a freak and reinforced all my feelings of inadequacy and failure. But after this party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing, because I decided that I wouldn't do any drinking when other people were around. Now, I had always been a gregarious kind of person, and I am now. But I became the kind of person who didn't much want other people around anymore. I didn't want to make plans to do things with the children in the weekends or in the evenings. I didn't even care any longer whether my husband sat and talked with me at night after the children went to bed. I just wanted everybody to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink in peace. But of course, there wasn't any peace, because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. And that's what booze had made of me. I was a prisoner, a lost soul in chains. And now, thanks to AA, I'm no longer a prisoner. I have a choice. I can take one drink, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. I no longer feel like a lost soul, because in spite of the fact that I fail frequently in the performance of various duties and responsibilities that I have, at long last, my life does have some direction. It does have some structure. It does have a way to go, even though I don't have goals any longer. I have a way. I have 12 steps. I have 12 traditions. And these will take me wherever I'm supposed to go. And when I get discouraged, which I do from time to time, and fall into the old ways of thinking and begin to kick the furniture and mutter curses under my breath and wonder why I have so little to show for the efforts I make and wonder what I've really found that's so different except sobriety. One time I even heard myself say that, "What's so different about your life except that you're sober? Except that I'm sober." When I came here, the only thing in the world I was looking for or even hoped to find was sobriety. Everything else, everything, and there's been so much that my cup runs over. And all of this is gravy, because all I was looking for was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose it, all I have to do is to think back on those last 2 years when I drank alone, late at night, and how I wandered up and down the stairs and through the halls in my house, always going down for that one last drink, time after time after time. And I remember I used to say to myself even then, there must be some purpose in this. You must be looking for something that's missing from your life. And even in my drunken confusion, I was right about that. I was looking for something. And thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you. I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. So when I look out at a crowd of people like you and realize all through that terrible time in rooms like this, you were here, and you had a vacancy, I realize what a wasteland my willfulness and my pride and my blindness had made of my life. And I thank God I found you when I did. I'm not proud of the things I've told you. I don't think any of us is proud. I spent years trying to forget things like this. But I know now that I must never forget. Lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA. Lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you, and God bless.